Hello, this is Jerry Pippin. On this Conspiracy Files program, we are going to present the story of a hand-picked cold warrior who found out the hard way that the government has ways of protecting its covert, dirty little secrets, even at the expense of some of its strongest allies. John McCarthy had a prize duty assignment with Special Forces in Southeast Asia during the 1960s. Stay tuned for a shocking story as told by a man who lived it. When this program is over, you will understand that conspiracy is the standard operating procedure of the United States government. John McCarthy, it's a pleasure having you on the air with me.
Thank you, Jerry.
How are things in Southern California?
They are warm today and sunny. And no clouds in the sky, nice, clean, fresh air in the ocean.
Now you're getting ready to go to Europe. You'll be gone for, I guess, a month or so.
A little longer than a month.
And you've been quite the world traveler in your whole career, and we'll get into that in a little bit here. What I thought I would do is just get you on the air with me, and I appreciate you consenting to do that, and letting our audience know a little bit about John McCarthy.
Well, in fact, my earliest recollection, after having been born in Boston, was getting on a very large plane, which happened to be a Pan Am Clipper, four engines.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing pictures of those things.
Yeah, and flying off across the United States to Seattle from Boston, and watching the Great Lakes go by and looking like puddles, and then going from Seattle to Japan on the USS Constitution, which took about 21 days going across the ocean. And I met up with my dad, who was there in the service with the occupation forces in late 1946, and we spent about 2.5 years in Japan and moved back to Kansas and then back to Boston for a year and then over to Germany for 3 years and back to the States and so forth. And then when my dad retired, I went in.
I started to say, you followed his tracks, I think, into the military.
I did, of course, I've seen different ways of life and how people lived all over the world and had comparisons with my own, and I've learned languages when I was a youngster.
How many languages do you speak now?
Oh, just a couple now, just German and Spanish, but I've lost most of my Japanese.
Well, that's two more than me.
It's amazing how many words are the same. And, you know, it's so easy for a child to learn because there's no barriers there. And I ended up being the interpreter in Japan between our hired help and my family. And the same thing happened in Germany. But in both cases, I asked my dad, when we were downtown Kobe, which was had been an industrial city, an aircraft manufacturing city, and the place was in rubble in late 46 as a result of firebombing during World War II. And I asked my dad, what happened? And he said, there was a war here. And I said, well, why? And he said, because the wrong guy was in charge. He said, but the Japanese people are very industrious, learn their language, they're great engineers, and pay attention to what they say. They're very kind people. So I did that. And then when we got to Munich, Germany in 1953, I had a similar question because one square block of the city of Munich had been preserved in rubble. And I asked my dad what happened here, and he said, well, we had a war. And I said, well, why? And he said, because the wrong guy was in charge. Well,
it seems to be the thing that goes on through history.
It does. And when I got to Vietnam, I found out the wrong guy was in charge, too.
Yeah.
In fact,
you mentioned
it was on the other side.
Right. I understand. You mentioned Kansas, and you just mentioned Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Your dad, he was stationed where in Kansas?
In Fort Leavenworth.
Well, you went to Fort Leavenworth later.
I did go,
but not the best way.
I went to what they refer to as the long course. They have a short course and a long course at Leavenworth, And that's at the Commanding General Staff College.
In other words, you were a prisoner.
Yes, and people who are polite refer to me as going to the long course. Yeah, and it's called the United States Disciplinary Barracks. We're jumping a bit ahead, but it's not a barracks at all. It was a penitentiary, which because of its conditions and the way people were treated, has been torn down a few years ago.
You were sentenced there to hard labor. I don't know. Does that really mean what it says?
Not making little ones out of big ones anymore as it used to. It's more isolation, confinement, and just they do have work programs within the system to make license plates and decals for cars at different military installations, and they have a farm unit which raised cattle and chickens. We had like about 3,000 chickens out there.
Now that's military prison. Is it all Army?
Well, at the time it was Army and Air Force, and I understand now, since I graduated from that organization in 1969, they have since changed, and I think the Navy and the Marines and the Coast Guard are doing their R&R there at this time.
Now, you know, on your website, and give it for our radio listeners, we have a link on our webpage to it. You go into great detail about how you were wrongly convicted.
Yeah, the website is http://johnmccarthy90066.tripod.com. But if you mess that up, all you have to do is Google John McCarthy, and out of about 8 million people, I'm number 4 or 5 on the list.
Yeah, and in addition to that, as we say, we have a link on this page so people can click over there without having to go through all that. You were in Special Forces.
Yeah, I entered the service in January of 1960. My dad had left the service in November of 59. And there was a shortage of funds and so forth, and a bit of a turmoil in the family at that point. I decided the best thing for me to do was to go ahead and go to the service. So
I went in 1961.
Yeah. Those days, were there wasn't any war going on that we knew about, although there was a war in Laos at the time that was a secret war. There was some advisor situations in South Vietnam, but they were rather limited in 1960. But I do recall one frightening time. We were about third week in basic training, and there was a class that we were attending immediately after lunch. And this was with Fort Ord, California. And most of us were sleepy and getting drowsy, and the subject matter was something to do with protocol, and oh my God, it was so boring, and the instructor was very, very boring to listen to, and all this was by design. All of a sudden, a guy runs up onto the stage, and he hands a message to the instructor, and the instructor reads off, says, "All leaves are canceled. The United States is now at war with North Korea. The North Korean divisions, totaling 800,000 men, have just crossed the 17th parallel, and all leaves are canceled, and you will, instead of having 8 weeks of the basic training, you'll get 2 weeks of rifle training, and you'll be put on board aircraft to go to Japan and then shipped to Korea to be the resistance force." And, of course, that woke us all up. Well, then they went into the program for that particular two-hour session, which was escape and evasion and how to act if you became a POW. So, of course, all of us paid strict attention. But that was their way of getting our attention. And, of course, it scared the hell out of us.
Sure.
My first thought was, I'm too young to die.
No.
I was only 17.
Yeah, right. Later on, you went to OCS, I take it.
Yeah, I spent 4 years enlisted, made sergeant, and I spent my first 4 years in Special Forces, and my time in Germany was spent with mobile training team.
Yeah, the Cold War was still on hot and heavy, and of course we had the Cuban Missile Crisis during that time.
We did, and we had contingency plans to evacuate most of the military out of Germany and into France across the Rhine River, and what we were going to do as Special Forces was stay behind. We had earmarked all of the tunnels and bridges on the secondary roads in Germany, in the entire country, and we were going to destroy those in the event the East Germans and the Russians came across the border from East Germany. And this would force the Russians onto the Autobahn, the main turnpike system in Germany, and therefore they would be taken out by tactical air. So that was our function, to be stay-behind teams in the event that the balloon went up, as we referred to it.
Yeah, now, you actually had several, I guess, hazardous duty assignments. One of them got you in trouble there. Was that in Laos or in Vietnam where this incident happened with the pistol going off?
I was on my second tour in Vietnam in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of events, one of the people who worked for us was found to have a photograph of all of the Americans who were working on this particular project, and there were seven of us, and it had our correct names above our heads. We were in fact operating at that time under embassy cover as Department of Defense field evaluation.
That meant you were in civilian clothes?
Absolutely.
Right.
And with cover identification. And we were under directions to have no open contact with any military in South Vietnam. And we thought this to be a legitimate portion of the cover for not associating us with this particular element, which happened to be made up of Cambodians. And these Cambodians were of a sect that was, in fact, the government in exile from Cambodia, very anti-Sihanouk. In fact, they had plans to assassinate him.
He was he was the head guy in Vietnam at the time in South Vietnam.
Who was?
No. The man you're talking about, was he in charge in Laos? I'm trying to remember my history back there. Sihanouk.
Sihanouk was the prince of Cambodia.
Cambodia, instead of Vietnam.
The king of Cambodia. Okay. And so this team, we had scheduled training for them and provide them equipment to dress them up in North Vietnamese to conduct assassinations in Cambodia and in South Vietnam, and under the direction of the CIA when required. When I arrived to take over as case officer, which is the term the CIA military intelligence for being the head cheese for one of these organizations.
Kind of a section chief.
Absolutely. And so when I arrived in September of 1967, little to my knowledge, this organization was about to be disbanded, but it had been in existence since 1965. And if we can fast track just a bit to the year 2000, it turns out that documents from the Lyndon Baines Johnson's library, State Department documents that were once top secret and declassified by the State Department, much to the chagrin of the CIA, had verbatim minutes of meetings of the National Security Council from 1966, which was a year prior to my assignment at this project, which was referred to as Cherry. There were seven projects, all named after trees, and a bit more on that later. But the this conversation at the National Security Council with President Johnson and all the members of the Security Council in attendance, which means that the CIA, the State Department, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and the Department of Defense, which is the military, was present, or representatives of those heads, if not the heads themselves. And Johnson's concern in June of 1966 was that he didn't want the war in Vietnam, which was heated up pretty good by then, about 150,000 of combat troops from the United States. He did not want it expanded into South, or into Cambodia. And this Cambodia comprised 60,000 square miles. And, of course, it's located directly west of South, of what was then South Vietnam. And on the other side of Cambodia was Thailand. So what he was concerned with was convincing Sihanouk that he did not want to assassinate him, even though Sihanouk at the time claimed that the CIA was organizing elements to do just that. And of course, all this was top secret, and nobody knew about it. Everything was compartmentalized back in 1966. Well, it turns out that LBJ, of course, directed the National Security Council and the members to carry information to the head of the Vietnamese government, to the head of the Royal Thai government, and letters hand-carried to Sihanouk himself in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, explaining that the United States had no intention of expanding the war in South Vietnam to Cambodia and had no intention of assassinating Sihanouk. And he wanted all the heads of state involved in this to know. Well, it turns out, 1967, in September, which was a year and a few months later, I was assigned as a case officer of Project Cherry, which had as its project, we had 12 Cambodians who were trained to assassinate Sihanouk. And these people were funded in violation of the National Security Council directives that the president gave them, that there would be no support, financial, logistical, military, or organization to assist them in operations against Cambodia, because that's not what Johnson wanted. So here I was, unwittingly, operating in violation of the president's directives, and in 67 he was still the president, and during the course of events, the third-ranking individual of this government in exile, we attempted to get him hired by like organizations because this system was shutting down in 67, supposedly for budgetary concerns. And during this process, this individual was found with the real names of the Americans in a photograph, plus some communications documents, which he should not have had.
In other words, he was a double agent.
Well, he was more than that. So in the process of taking him for interrogation, he was shot from outside the vehicle that we were traveling in.
Yeah, on your website, you go into great detail about that, and evidently there was a motorcycle rider that left ahead of you.
Well, when we picked him up from his apartment, there was an individual there who should not have been there.
Uh-huh.
Because of the strict protocol under which we were operating, this individual knew that we had picked him up and had left on a motorcycle. ensured that there were zero commerci elements working in cross-border operations into Cambodia, because that would violate the trust and the word that Johnson was putting out to them in 1966. So what we have here is a government within the government deciding, the hell with what the president wants. We're just going to go ahead and do what we want, because we want to expand this war and continue it.
In fact, as we continue in the show, we're going to get into that and show that's still happening today, I think. But go ahead with the story.
Okay. This individual was shot while we were on the way to the area where he used to be interrogated.
Now, you had a pistol.
Yeah, I had a .38 caliber pistol.
And it was, the sergeant was driving, I think.
Right. He had a 9mm, which is the same as a .38. Uh-huh. And I had a .38, which was over the back seat of the car. And all the windows were down in case we had to return fire. And a bullet came through the front windshield as we were driving. And this was at 3 o'clock in the morning. A bullet came through the front windshield. So whoever aimed at the car aimed it between the headlights, I guess, which is what we would have instructed them to do, which goes back to this guy on the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hit, and we examined him, and it appeared that was dead. But as soon as the bullet came through the windshield, I reacted and pulled off a round from my .38, which went out the left side passenger door.
So
the left side.
Your weapon didn't hit him at all.
No.
But they had a court martial, and they said you did.
Yeah, they had an expert witness who said that the 5mm hole was a contact type, which meant the muzzle of the weapon was either tightly or loosely, but in either case, up against the skin, and therefore, this must have been premeditated murder. Even though I had a .38, which is 9mm, and you can't put a 9mm bullet through a 5mm hole. So, a .22, which is what the diameter of the hole was, could either be made by a .22 caliber or a .223 caliber, which is an M16. There were 100 million M16 bullets fired during that war, and I'm sure we don't know where all of them went. But on this particular night, this one that came through the windshield and hit him, or came through the left rear window and threw him and out the windshield, I can't tell which one happened first one way or the other, but there was no powder burns or powder tattooing on the...
Now, this expert witness later recanted this?
Yeah, he did.
Did he ever say why he testified that?
Well, he didn't say why he testified that way, and nor did he say why he recanted. But his testimony before the court-martial compelled them to convict me and sentence me to life imprisonment, even though I was facing the death penalty. So, and this was in January of 1968, is when the court-martial occurred. And it was a two-day court-martial, and on the second day at 7 o'clock at night, I was convicted and sentenced to life. And at 7:25, the Tet Offensive started. And that's when all hell broke loose all over South Vietnam. So if anybody is familiar with that period of time, they can realize when all this went down. In September of 1968, this doctor decided to recant his in-court testimony in writing. Now, strangely enough, this doctor was the first person to testify, the first witness. And when he got off the witness stand, he took a seat in the back of the courtroom. Well, my attorney noticed that and mentioned it to the judge. And he said, isn't this rather unusual? And so the judge asked the prosecutor, do you plan on recalling him as a witness? And he said, well, no, Your Honor, I don't. And he said, well, he's a friend of the court, so we'll let him stay.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this in front of the jury. He was a friend of the court.
Mm-hmm.
That was nice. Well, when this man wrote the recantation in September, which was 8 months later, he said, after reviewing the record of trial, I've decided that what I said was smoke and some other.
kind of a magic bullet theory going in the 60s.
You won't believe how close you are to the magic bullet theory. Because this recantation, when it was found, was in 1970. So the trial was in January of 68. The recantation was in September of 68. And the good doctor decided he didn't need to talk to me or present me with his new findings, nor my attorney. But he did turn this over to Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Fink, who was the chief of pathology at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C. And this Colonel Pierre Fink had done the autopsy on John F. Kennedy in 63
wow.
and testified before the Warren Commission as to the magic bullet theory, which convinced the Warren Commission that Oswald was the lone gunman and that there was no conspiracy to kill our president. So this has come full circle with the magic bullet. Now, Pierre Fink, who is now retired and living in Switzerland, was questioned by my attorney, my military attorney, in 1968, and asked if he had any new evidence with respect to Dr. Mason, who had been the expert witness at trial. And he said no, he had no information, and yet this file was found mysteriously. My military attorney was having a cup of coffee in the Pentagon cafeteria, and this attorney from the Institute of Pathology came by and said, by the way, have you seen the McCarthy file in Pierre Fink's office over at Bethesda? And he said, hell no. He said, I've been told there was no file. He said, well, let's go. So they went over there, opened up the file in Colonel Fink's office, and the top file was the recantation by Mason. The second file was an FBI report saying that there was a piece of quartz found on the bullet fragment that Mason had submitted, which we didn't even know anything about, and that there was a piece of quartz...
That would indicate glass.
That would indicate something before it hit him.
Yeah.
That's called exculpatory evidence.
Right.
That means that it would have been impossible for me to do this because of those two documents alone. Now, there was other documents in there, but this file was presented to the Court of Military Appeals, or the Court of Military Review, excuse me, which is the first step after a court-martial to review to see if they've done their proper deed. And the Court of Military Review determined that this was newly found evidence and fraud on the court, and they overturned a premeditated murder conviction on that alone. That was on the recantation. They didn't even address the FBI report. So what we have here is the Supreme Court decided in 1963 that Brady versus Maryland was a good law to have, so that if there's any exculpatory evidence that comes out, it must be provided to the defendant. And that only seems right and just, but... this forensic pathologist who testified at the trial, Dr. Mason, and forensic pathologist means he knows something about the coordination of medical and law. And this other guy, Pierre Fink, also is a forensic pathologist and knows something about medicine and the law. Both of them should have turned this information over to the defense counsel and to me, because it eventually was used to overturn the premeditated murder conviction. And those people are forensic pathologists. Now, here's the kicker. I told you that Dr. Fink is now living in Switzerland.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, Dr. Mason is not retired.
Oh, really?
Up until last year, he was the coroner of Santa Cruz County, in Santa Cruz, California.
Near what used to be Fort Orange.
Yes. And he is
John McCarthy, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. I want to get to the question of why they prosecuted you to begin with. It just appears really that they could have let this gone on out the window. You know, I mean, obviously there were a lot. If you were looking for an excuse, even if you had shot him, that we were in more or less a counterintelligence operation. It just seems strange that they...
If I'd have shot him, I'd have said so.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, you know, it just seems to me they went out of their way to... It looks like they went out of their way to prosecute.
I'm responsible for a number of deaths in the name of the United States government, which I am not proud of, but not this guy.
Okay. We'll be right back in the car. Jim Mars.
If we use the ability to electronically capture airplanes and fly them by remote control against the wishes of anybody on board, and if we crash those planes into your buildings and you got double indemnity and, you know, more money out of them than they're worth, and we could use that as an excuse or provocation to start a war, hey, this would take care of everything.
Over the next few months, we are going to bring to the public the ugly face of what really happened on 9/11 and who is behind it.
Some senators have described this as a second Pearl Harbor.
There have been many excellent documentaries on 9/11. Many of these documentaries have uncovered much of the hidden secrets behind the story.
That had been planned for at least a year.
On our series, we're going to attempt to put a face on all of this. The people. Why they did it. Who did it?
We are not exactly sure at the moment of the whereabouts of the Secretary of Defense.
We will attempt to bring you the facts, plain and simple. Our 9/11 series will name the names. We'll tell you who did it. And we'll present the evidence to back up that story. 9/11, now on the Jerry Pippen Show.